طفلة تمتطي فوسا قزح، طفلة تمتطي فوسا قزح من مخيام.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Fahm and is continued in his memory. This broadcast was produced by Despina Moutsouris. And I am your host, John Roberts. We begin this morning with a report from our colleague in Bethlehem, Samer Jaber, who has written a new article for the journal Al Arabi. Samer suggested that we might be interested in reading it on This Week in Palestine. We are. It is a follow-up on the Rasmia O'Day case. Samer writes, Rasmia O'Day, the Chicago-based Palestinian-American community leader, will soon find herself in a courtroom once more. The 68-year-old has been at the center of a U.S. legal storm for more than 2 years, having been indicted for unlawful procurement of naturalization. She was sentenced to 18 months in prison in March 2015, but remains free on bail pending an appeal against this verdict. It was claimed that during her application for citizenship a decade ago, she knowingly failed to disclose that she had been convicted on terrorist charges by an Israeli military court. She will take the stand and appeal against the ruling of a Detroit court in a bid to secure her freedom. O'Day has been sentenced to 18 months of imprisonment, fined $1,000, and had her U.S. citizenship revoked in a March hearing. O'Day's defense team maintained the sentence was unfair and her trial deliberately excluded information that would have mitigated her alleged actions. Many in the activist community believe that she was targeted for her strident advocacy of Palestinian issues. Missing from the accounts of mainstream media is the context. The reams of articles about O'Day failed to mention that her arrest by Israel came against the backdrop of military occupation of her homeland. While her lawyers tried to share this information with the court and public, it was ruled inadmissible. The authorities and individuals who prosecuted the case did not welcome alternative media outlets. However, the efforts of activists and people of conscience ensured many people inside the U.S. and around the world followed the news of her sentence. The legal question focused on whether O'Day mentioned in her visa and citizenship applications that she had been imprisoned. Without context, one would not know if Rasmia merely violated immigration law or if she was pushed to do so because she did not believe that she would receive fair treatment from the U.S. authorities. Without context, one would not know of her role as a co-founder of the Arab American Action Network. Her activism put O'Day on the FBI's radar, and it appears someone started digging through her past. It would indeed seem that the U.S. authorities, in collaboration with other authorities, that is Israel, are working to keep Palestinian activists at bay. The court further kept out information related to the role of occupation in radicalizing people's reaction to oppression. In fact, for many colonized or oppressed peoples, resistance is a duty. Active resistance under military occupation is a legally accepted action for individuals to protect their rights in life and national rights according to international law, specifically under Article 51 of the UN Charter. Also, defending one's own life by all means is a human right not criminalized by U.S. law. O'Day was told by the judge that she could not mention her 1969 experience in an Israeli jail, during which a confession of complicity in two Jerusalem bombings was extracted from her through torture. A gag order was given to her to not tell the court that sleep deprivation, food starvation, and being stripped of her clothes in front of male prisoners were among the torture methods used against her. She was not allowed to tell the jury that her interrogators had raped her with a wooden stick. By not allowing this evidence, the court ended up recognizing the legality of the confession extracted under torture. After O'Day tried mentioning her torture at the hearing, the judge added an extra 3 months of jail time to her sentence. Preventing her from telling her story deprived her of a defense in which she would be considered a victim of torture. If O'Day was viewed by the court as a victim of torture, then it may be considered an extenuating circumstance to help explain her allegedly fraudulent action. A verified claim of torture could even have the effect of invalidating her conviction by an Israeli military court and expunging her criminal record, at least in the United States. Moreover, it would lay the groundwork for considering O'Day's case to be politically motivated. In filing her visa, immigration, and citizenship applications, O'Day did not lie when she marked the negative box when answering if she spent any period of time in prison for committing a crime. The 10 years O'Day served was not for a crime, but was a political internment in an Israeli jail. O'Day's issues are even more complicated when looking at the different definitions of freedom fighters, dissidents, and dissenters used in the United States. For example, the U.S.-supported mercenaries known as the Contras and many graduates of the School of the Americas are considered by the United States government to be freedom fighters. It's important in this context to remember that Nelson Mandela remained on the U.S. terrorist list long after the Pretoria regime collapsed. If the U.S. authorities want to deport O'Day, they should deport her to her country, Palestine. U.S. law obliges the Department of Homeland Security and the State Department to make sure that a deported person should be safe and will not be persecuted based on civil actions. There is no way, however, that the U.S. can assure her safety. Palestine is occupied, with Israel exercising daily violations of the rights of Palestinian people. Thus, the judge wants to deport her to Jordan. The U.S. views the Palestinian struggle as a criminal act and categorizes it as an act of terror within the framework of the U.S.-brokered peace process. O'Day's conviction is seen by human rights advocates as an embodiment of the U.S. system. Rasmea is a strong human being. She also raised the morale of people surrounding her when the situation was harsh and gloomy, a mutual friend told me. Individuals and groups around the world should take a strong stand to support O'Day. She has walked a long path of suffering without losing sight of dignity and without compromising her principles. She turned down a plea deal offered last year to be immediately deported without a jail sentence because, quote, I wanted to come here and tell my story, unquote. And O'Day faces injustice one more time. Every time I rebuilt my life, she said, Something else from outside would put me back to zero. She is a paragon of resilience and determination that shine with her human spirit. O'Day is appealing against the court's conviction. People in the United States, in Palestine, and everywhere in between now have the moral obligation to stand by her. We must fight to overturn O'Day's conviction with media campaigns, donations, and calling the congressional representatives to ask them to strike down O'Day's conviction. President Obama can also be asked to use his executive power to prevent her deportation. And that was an article written in Bethlehem by journalist and activist Samer Jaber, first published in the Palestinian journal Al Arabi. And now on to our feature presentation, which this morning is a speech by journalist and author Max Blumenthal, who was on the ground in Gaza through the entire Israeli bombardment of Gaza in the summer of 2014, and has written a book reporting on that war called The 51-Day War, Ruin and Resistance in Gaza. This morning he discusses his book and takes us beyond the horrific description of the Israeli assault to include incisive political analysis, including puncturing many of the myths the Western media insists on repeating to this day concerning that war. The mainstream media are dismissive of Blumenthal, probably because of his on-the-ground factual reporting that challenges much of the mainstream media's hyping of the factually incorrect Israeli narrative that has led to none of the major news publications reviewing his book. Not the New York Times, not the Washington Post, nor the Boston Globe. He is persona non grata to the Jewish lobby, and therefore to the mainstream media. However, it should be noted that the attacks on Max Blumenthal never include challenging the accuracy of his reports because they are so meticulously documented. He is an incredibly important voice that needs to be heard, which is why we so often feature him on This Week in Palestine. Here is the interview on KPFA Radio, our feature presentation this morning.
On July 8, 2014, Israel launched airstrikes on Hamas-controlled Gaza, followed by a ground invasion. The ensuing 51 days of war left more than 2,200 people dead, the vast majority of whom were Palestinian civilians, including over 500 children. During the assault, at least 10,000 homes were destroyed, and according to the United Nations, nearly 300,000 Palestinians were displaced. Our guest on the telephone, Max Blumenthal, was in Gaza at the time, and he has written a brilliant, very disturbing, and vivid portrait of what he saw and experienced while there. The name of it, The 51-Day War, Ruin and Resistance in Gaza. Max Blumenthal, author of Republican Gomorrah, a New York Times and Los Angeles Times bestseller, and Goliath, which won the Lannan Foundation Cultural Freedom Notable Book Award, a senior writer for Alternet, and you see his stuff all over the place, including videos on Al Jazeera English, etc. Max Blumenthal, welcome to KPFA's microphone. So glad to have you.
Good to be on with you.
So this book begins with a description of what it's like to arrive at the border of Gaza. And why don't you tell us that again for those of us who have not been there?
Well, the book opens with a photograph by my colleague Dan Cohen, who entered with me during the war, during a five-day ceasefire, which was actually a seven-day ceasefire, which was the first real extended ceasefire during the war. And when you enter Gaza after passing through the Erez crossing, which is basically off limits to anyone except accredited press and aid workers, people from the Gaza Strip can't really generally leave there. You go down a long corridor. You pass through a concrete wall and a metal door. The metal door opens. It's a dystopian science fiction movie come to life. You walk through the door and you're in Gaza. The door shuts behind you. You hear a drone over your head. You see the buffer zone in front of you, which is off limits to anyone on the Gaza Strip. And to your right, down a long wall constructed of blast concrete, is a remote-controlled machine gun, which is operated by an all-female corps of Israeli soldiers from tens of kilometers away in the Negev Desert, who will aim at and shoot anyone entering the buffer zone whose gait, in other words, whose posture and the way they walk, matches that of what they consider to be a terrorist. And so that really highlights the entire situation of people in the Gaza Strip. They are in a walled-off ghetto, whose walls are perched with machine guns, whose skies are filled with Hermes 450 drones, which are weaponized with U.S.-supplied Hellfire missiles, who are patrolled by F-16s, and whose seas are patrolled by Corvette boats supplied at a deep discount by the German government to the Israeli Navy as part of Holocaust reparations, which prevent people from the Gaza Strip fishermen from fishing more than 3 kilometers at sea. Every neighborhood is honeycombed with collaborators who are induced into spying for the Israeli security services. Everyone is watched. It is one of the most heavily surveilled, controlled, and oppressed pieces of earth. And to be in there during a war is to really feel like you're in a cage with people who are being burned alive. And that really sets the stage for what you read in the next 200 pages of my book as we follow the 51-day war from its origins in East Jerusalem and the West Bank to the Gaza Strip.
And why, you were there, so that's one reason, but why this 51-day war? As you mentioned, you say the Gaza Strip is a ghetto of children. The majority is under the age of 18 of its population there, and that the formative years of these young people has been marked by 3 major military assaults. These are their rites of passage, and surely the 4th is on its way, probably even as we speak. So why is this one important?
Well, this was the war that in which Israel revealed its full malevolent capacity. I mean, for years we had been hearing Israeli political leadership and cultural public figures in Israel call for wiping the Gaza Strip off the map, for flattening Gaza. This is a common refrain, especially among the right-wing Israeli political class, which is dominant now. And we saw it take place. We saw them literally, the Israeli military literally flatten the Gaza Strip. At least 20% of it lies in ruins right now. 18,000 homes are destroyed. Over 400 factories and businesses are completely destroyed. Close to 100,000 people are still homeless or forced to live with relatives or in shelters. The entire border region, the entire area bordering what is Israel, where many of these people in the Gaza Strip have legitimate claims to homes and land, is in rubble. And there has been absolutely no rebuilding process a year later. So we saw what Israel was capable of, and Israel demonstrated that it could get away with it. We're talking about 3 million bullets fired in this war. We're talking about more explosives used between the period of July 7th and August 8th than the United States used in one bomb on Hiroshima. We're talking about thousands upon thousands of artillery shells concentrated in civilian areas. So the war extended for 51 days when it really didn't have to. That's another aspect of the book that I wanted to, of the narrative of the war that I wanted to reinforce, which is that the United States and the Egyptian military junta, which is almost more Israeli than Israel in its relationship to the Gaza Strip, obstructed diplomacy in order to prevent Hamas the government of the Gaza Strip from gaining any humanitarian concessions. And all of the demands that they offered at the beginning of the war in exchange for a 10-year truce with Israel were humanitarian in nature. They called for an airport. They called for a seaport. They called for more permits for people in the Gaza Strip to go to Jerusalem this month during Ramadan to pray, more permits for people to go out and study. All of these were offered in exchange for a 10-year ceasefire, which would have guaranteed security for Israelis, particularly in the south. And the United States under John Kerry, who, by the way, we've just learned has had $1 million in investments in Israeli natural gas reserves, obstructed this and prevented it from happening, extending the war and wasting the lives of thousands of some 2,000 people in the Gaza Strip. As you mentioned, over 500 of them were children. And you mentioned this phrase that I used, ghetto of children. Most people in the Gaza Strip are under 18, but a substantial percentage of those who are under 18 are actually under 7 years old, which means that they have known nothing but siege. They've known nothing but war and this grinding rebuilding process, which has been obstructed by the international community.
Max Blumenthal, our guest on the telephone, journalist, writer, video documentarian, author. His newest book is The 51-Day War, Ruin and Resistance in Gaza, about the most recent Israeli military offensive, which was July of 2014, coming right up on the one-year anniversary. So I think I'm going to your quote here from Arnon Sofer, who is a professor at the University of Haifa, and he's been consultant to many Israeli governments, and perhaps most pertinently, as you mentioned, to Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. But Mr. Sofer says, if we, Israel, wants to remain alive, we will have to kill and kill and kill all day, every day. So the Sharon policy, which Mr. Sofer helped
design
of disengagement, really changed everything. You're describing a situation in Gaza which is so horrific, but in fact it grew out of something that was not that horrific, and now it's like cast in stone. It's like cemented in. It's hard to believe anyone could ever escape this, what is obviously, as you describe, an effort to utterly annihilate all of these people. Goodbye, goodbye, goodbye. Wipe them off the face of the earth. Talk about the disengagement, quote unquote, and the effects that it had on international thinking as well as the realities of on the ground in Gaza.
Well, the agenda wasn't necessarily to annihilate. Although you could argue that the agenda was genocidal, I see no Israeli plan to exterminate Palestinians. The agenda was simply to warehouse them in perpetuity, to transform the Palestinians of the Gaza Strip into surplus humanity, which is a really anachronistic concept, which unfortunately is spreading around the world. Sharon's disengagement, in which he pulled out 9,000 fanatical religious nationalist settlers, was opposed by the far right in Israel, by the religious nationalist movement. And so a lot of liberals in Israel and in the U.S. within the American kind of liberal intelligentsia were duped into supporting it and believing that what Sharon wanted was peace. They, of course, didn't listen to the statements of Sharon's advisors like Sofer, who said that the goal was not to pave the path to peace, but to improve Israel's demographic majority of Jews by bringing more of these settlers into the Israeli settlement blocks. Israel got a letter, a guarantee from George W. Bush at the time that in exchange for the disengagement, they would get to keep all of the major settlement blocks which encircle East Jerusalem, cutting it off from the West Bank and basically preventing a Palestinian capital in East Jerusalem in a future state of Israel. So they basically get a huge chunk of the West Bank, along with all the resources that lay therein. Beyond that, Sharon's advisor, Dov Weisglass, said on the record, he told Haaretz, this, the whole purpose of the disengagement is to freeze the peace process, to put the peace process in formaldehyde. And then if you look even further and listen to the words of then Shin Bet director Avi Dichter, the disengagement will give our army more freedom to operate. Because there aren't Jews in the Gaza Strip, Jewish settlers, we can now use 2,000-pound fragmentation bombs. We can use techniques with artillery we hadn't used before. So it was clear what was going to happen after the disengagement. Israel promptly placed the Gaza Strip under siege. Hamas comes to power. They actually won elections in the West Bank. Their leadership is kidnapped by the Palestinian Authority, which is whose security forces are trained by the U.S. and by the quartet led by Tony Blair. They're banned in the West Bank. They win the Gaza Strip, and Israel initiates a series of attacks under a doctrine which it called the Dahiyah Doctrine. Because the Gaza Strip is now kind of a stateless frontier region, which is controlled from the outside and not from within as it was before, controlled from the outside according to the kind of panopticon where the jailer controls just 1% of the prison, the perimeter. Israel is going to actually attack the civilian population in order to demoralize it and try to induce it into opposing Hamas. But Dahiyah is actually the neighborhood south of Beirut where Israel tested this strategy against Hezbollah in 2006. And South Lebanon is another area that Israel's tried and failed to occupy, which it considers a frontier region. So in these two frontier regions, the then northern commander of the Israeli army, who is now the chief of staff of the Israeli army, the most important position in the Israeli military and one of the most important positions of in Israeli public life, said that all residents of South Lebanon are Hassan Nasrallah, the spiritual leader of Hezbollah, and all residents of the Gaza Strip are Khaled Mishal, the leader of Hamas's Politburo. In other words, if we're going to attack Hamas or Hezbollah, we're not going to attack their military positions. We will attack and punish the civilian population with disproportionate force in order to induce them into turning on the political leadership that they support. And that's what every war has looked like since the disengagement of the Gaza Strip and since the second invasion of southern Lebanon in 2006. And the violence of these wars continues to escalate as you see the Israeli Goliath frustrated by its inability to move the civilian population, to demoralize the civilian population. And what you see in my book, The 51-Day War, is the portrait of a civilian population that refuses to give up and that supports almost totally the armed resistance factions of the Gaza Strip, which are largely fighting a defensive war, attacking exclusively military targets, while the Israeli military, one of the most powerful militaries in the world, backed with the full support of the world's lone superpower, attacks helpless civilians. That is the scenario that's unfolded as a result of the disengagement. And there's no strategy that the U.S. or Israel is putting forward to alter this dynamic.
Max Blumenthal, our guest on the telephone, author of The 51-Day War, Ruin and Resistance in Gaza. The 51-Day War began on July 8th, 2014, and Max was there at the time. And, of course, it was all begun under with lies and an incredible publicity campaign to rile up the Israeli citizens, because it's not only the citizens of Gaza that are being manipulated or attempted to be, but it turns out the Israeli citizenry is much more manipulable, maybe is what I'm trying to say. They succumbed.
Well, it was really unfortunate, and our media succumbed as well. I was one of the reporters who, before I had even headed off to Palestine to cover the war, before the war was happening, I was one of the reporters in independent media who exposed the deception that would lead to the war. And it was well known within the international press corps that this deception was taking place, and within the Israeli press corps. But reporters followed the rules, as I'll explain to you right now.
We should say that this was the impetus that was used was the kidnapping of three young Israeli men, and in fact the killing of those three men. And the government knew that they had been killed, but they told the parents that they were probably still alive. Anyway,
yeah, just to try to give you a brief overview of what happened. It was on June 12th, three Jewish Israeli hitchhikers disappeared in the West Bank near the southern city of Hebron. It turned out that they were kidnapped by a rogue Hamas cell without orders from above. In the past, when there's been a kidnapping, it's been authorized by Hamas's Politburo with approval from the armed wing. This was a family behind this, or a clan around Hebron behind this kidnapping, who are known for violating Hamas directives in order to break ceasefires. And that's kind of what they did here. They wanted to kidnap these three teens in order to create sort of a political momentum for a prisoner swap, the kind of which we saw when Gilad Shalit was released in the Gaza Strip in 2011. And the kidnapping went wrong right away. One of the teens tried to phone the police. The police had a recording of the teen trying to phone them, and they had a recording of gunshots and the killers singing in celebration of killing these three teens. The car of the teen in which the teens were killed was found. It had been torched. There were bullets, DNA, and blood inside. And the Israeli Shin Bet, the Intelligence General Security Service, lied to the parents of these teens, said that they were still somewhere out there, even though they knew they were dead. Netanyahu knew they were dead. Netanyahu knew that they would not be found. And he and the military promptly ordered a gag order on all media, preventing Israeli media and all foreign correspondents working with credentials in Israel-Palestine from reporting on the details of the case. The gag order was actually revealed by Mondo Weiss, an independent online magazine that I write for. So the Israeli public had no idea the teens were dead. They thought they were out there. The Israeli military launches Operation Brothers Keeper to look for the teens, which was actually a pretext for arresting many of the prisoners who were released in the Gilad Shalit swap, arresting Hamas's political leadership, arresting students at Bir Zeit University affiliated with Hamas. They did so in full cooperation with the Palestinian Authority. And Hamas is watching this from the Gaza Strip and considers this to be an act of war. Their leadership is under attack in the West Bank, being arrested without charges. Benjamin Netanyahu is inciting against Palestinians in public all along and declaring that, and then when the bodies are finally discovered.
Well, there were yellow ribbons in New York. I mean, it was all over the planet. People were like, bring back our boys.
Basically, it was a coordinated campaign, and everything was set up so that when the boys were discovered, all hell would break loose. And that's exactly what happened. And Netanyahu appears when the boys are discovered many days later, right near the house of one of the killers, whose family had already been interrogated a day after the disappearance by the Shin Bet. It was discovered by volunteer Israeli hikers. It wasn't discovered really by the Israeli police. With all of their advanced mapping and satellite capacity, they couldn't find these bodies, which are in a shallow grave on the property of the killer, whose name was known to the Shin Bet. Netanyahu appears before the public and declares vengeance for the blood of a small child even Satan has not yet created. He was quoting from the poem of Haim Bialik, who is a turn-of-the-century Hebrew poet living in the Pale of Settlement, writing a poem. He's quoting from a poem about a pogrom against Jews. Netanyahu, the implication of his statement was that a pogrom had just been committed against the whole of Jewish Israeli society. Within 24 hours, a Palestinian boy, Mohammed Abu Khader, had been captured by Jewish Israeli zealots, fed gasoline down his throat, and burned alive. Now East Jerusalem is on fire. On Netanyahu proceeds to declare that all of Hamas is responsible for these killings. Israel on July 7th, not July 8th, but July 7th, that's why I call this the 51-day war, launches airstrikes on the Gaza Strip and kills seven important Hamas-linked military operatives. Hamas responds with a volley of rockets, including fairly new long-range rockets like the M-75, which can reach Jerusalem. And in East Jerusalem, in the Shufat neighborhood, where Mohammed Abu Huda was kidnapped from his home by these fanatics, I describe members of the Abu Huda family watching the rockets, the flare of the rockets in the sky, listening to the air raid sirens, and one of them declaring that rocket is for Mohammed. And that's how this response from Hamas's armed wing, the Al-Qassam Brigade, was understood by people who were being preyed upon. It was understood as an attempt to provide them with security and deterrent capacity. A few days later, on July 12th, Israel authorizes the ground invasion. And so a deception by the Israeli government leads to the most brutal assault on the Gaza Strip in history, and decimates the lives of tens of thousands. But it all started in a field just a few kilometers from Hebron at an intersection, and that's really where my book starts. Mm.
Max Blumenthal, our guest, and his book, The 51-Day War, Ruin and Resistance in Gaza, published by Nation Books. He also has written for The Nation. When you go on from this beginning, and I can't imagine what it was like to be there while this war is being waged. I can't imagine what it's like to live in Gaza. And that's why I was feeling like it's just hopeless. Everything is hopeless. There's no escape. The Israelis can turn off the electricity, turn off the gas, turn off the food deliveries, turn off everything at any moment, and have more than once. Where do you come away from this besides in utter outrage? And your book certainly describes why all of us should be outraged. What else can we come away with this besides outrage and despair?
Well, I followed the situation as far as I followed it as far as I could, the post-war situation in which people are forced to live through one of the worst winters in the history of the region, without homes, without shelter, where people in the town of Hosea, which was absolutely destroyed and were the residents were just terrorized for 9 days when they were occupied by Israeli soldiers, are living in shipping containers. I write about, you know, it was difficult for me to keep up with friends in Gaza while writing the book because they had electricity for 4 hours a day as they're running around trying to file with the UN to get their destroyed homes rebuilt. The situation is absolutely hopeless. There have been something like 68 suicides documented since the end of the war. And suicide is now rampant. About 500 people from the Gaza Strip drowned in the Mediterranean Sea as they tried to escape on a smuggler ship after escaping through tunnels. I mean, we're talking about entire families escaping this hermetically sealed ghetto through tunnels, then spending their life savings to go in a rickety fishing boat and then drowning at sea when another arrival smuggler rammed the boat. That's something that's never happened in the history of the Gaza Strip. That's something that hasn't happened in Palestinian society where people are desperate to leave. And I can tell you that most of my friends in the Gaza Strip who are English speakers, who are like the kind of, you know, highly educated cosmopolitan people who are journalists and translators, they all want to leave. They're making plans to leave. They see no future in a place that has been destroyed, and that's exactly the way that the state of Israel wants it. Barack Obama stood by and allowed this to happen. And not only that, he resupplied Israel with artillery, with mortars, during the height of this war. So the only response, as he said, is complete outrage. And I think there's only one thing that we can do as Americans, as taxpayers who are funding the decimation of an entire people, and that is to support the BDS movement, the movement to boycott, divest from, and sanction Israel. We have no other recourse politically when both of our parties support the ethnic cleansing and dispossession of Palestinians without a second thought, including Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. We have no other outlet except for this movement. So anyone who opposes this movement is offering Palestinians no other choice but the choice that many young men in neighborhoods in Gaza like Shujaiya and Hosea and Rafah took during the war, which was to take up arms and fight for their own freedom, as so many people have done before. I prefer nonviolence, and that's why I think that it's important to support BDS and stop the, stop the delaying tactics and the arguments and the artifice. That's really, I think, one of the takeaways from this book, even though I don't make any political recommendations or prescriptions, and it's just kind of a clinical journalistic overview.
Max Blumenthal, our guest on the phone, and his latest book is The 51-Day War, Ruin and Resistance in Gaza, published by Nation Books. And, sir, I thank you for writing this book, and I thank you for joining us this afternoon. Appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me.
That was journalist and author Max Blumenthal, interviewed on KPFA Radio on his book, The 51-Day War, Ruin and Resistance in Gaza. And finally, this report from the International Middle East Media Center, a BDS update. SodaStream announced that it will finalize the closure of its West Bank factory in 2 weeks. SodaStream CEO Daniel Birbaum commented earlier that the boycott only had a marginal effect on their business and accusing the movement of anti-Semitism. Mahmoud Nawajah, the Palestine Boycott National Committee General Coordinator, said this week, "Coming just as French multinational Veolia has abandoned the Israeli market following a 7-year campaign against its support for settlements that cost it billions of dollars, SodaStream's announcement today provides further proof that the BDS movement is increasingly able to hold corporate criminals to account for their role in Israeli apartheid and colonialism." SodaStream may wish to try and smear our movement, but it's clear that BDS campaigning and the Scarlett Johansson controversy has persuaded retailers across Europe and North America to drop SodaStream and contributed to SodaStream's share price to tumble by half in the space of a year. Even when this closure goes ahead, SodaStream will remain implicit in the displacement of Palestinians. Its new Lahavim factory is close to Rahat, a planned township in the Negev Desert, where Palestinian Bedouins are being forcefully transferred against their will. SodaStream, as a beneficiary of this plan, is complicit with this violation of human rights. Israel willfully destroys the Palestinian economy in the West Bank, leading to unemployment and economic crisis. The way to tackle this is to challenge Israel's system of colonialism and apartheid. The BDS movement is opposed to all forms of racism, including anti-Semitism and Islamophobia. The BNC is the Palestinian Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions National Committee, the broad coalition of Palestinian civil society organizations that work together to support the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions movement. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org or listen to us at any time via the archive found on the WZBC homepage. Simply click on Archive and go to Sunday morning, 8 a.m., and click on Listen. Each program is on this archive for 2 weeks. To reach our permanent archive to hear any of our past broadcasts, go to truthandjusticeradio.org and click on This Week in Palestine Archives. It is all there. Thanks for listening, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.